The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 465. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. To comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, you can simply comment down here below if you're watching on Facebook Live, or you can also comment by sending me an email at bicycletalk, the numeral one, at gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's rant of the week. Why aren't governments paying people to bike to work? Seems like a simple thing, doesn't it? Kind of a simple thing. Anyway, there I've got a piece that also comes out of one of my favorite news sites called Momentum out of Canada. And it says, here's why government should start paying people to ride their bike to work. I like this argument. I think this is good. It's a good rant. We'll explore it more in the show today. Also, in my rant section, we often talk about sidewalk riding here and how some municipalities do not allow it and restrict it and also fine people for doing it. One of those places is New York City. To the NYPD, just blacks and Hispanics ride on sidewalks. We will discuss this a little bit more when we get into the show. I thought this was very interesting. Talking about profiling. Anyway, when we get into the discussion on this a little bit further, you'll see exactly how this has worked out. So it's very interesting. On a positive side, the Cyclocross Nationals. Yay! They were last weekend. They were really cool. There were some great races out there. We got some local shout outs coming up, and I will talk about that a whole lot more when we get into the show. And I also just need to give a big shout out to, there are a number of categories, but one has got to be the New England seasoned men. Yes, the seasoned men, you know, those guys that happen to be my age and above. Yeah, that would be 70 plus. Anyway, we will talk more about that in the show. And of course, all the others too. They're not the only first place rider here. Anyway, let's move on. I found a YouTube site which is worth visiting. It's called Oh the Urbanity. And I got to tell you, I've watched a couple of videos on this. It is well worth doing a check on. This is a big shout out to it, called Oh the Urbanity. The Urbanity traverses cities by foot, bike, and public transit, and aims to make informative and hopefully entertaining videos combining streetscapes and demographic data. And they're based in Montreal, but they have things all over the world. And on that, I'm going to do a really big shout out to Victoria, British Columbia. Small city, as far as cities go, you know, 80,000 or so, I think. Plus, you know, you add all the outlyings and it comes out well over 100,000 people. But boy, are they doing it right. That, and the video about Victoria, BC is worth watching. If you're in the process of putting together some sort of presentation that you might be planning on showing to your local government, this would be a good one to watch before you do it. They did a lot of things right, and they're, of course, not the top dog up in Canada as far as cycling cities goes. That has to go to Montreal, but I don't know. If you do comparison to comparison, I think they got them beat. Now, they also have a weather situation there. The weather situation they have is that it is not as snowy and cold as Montreal is. And it, even though it is in Canada, the weather tends to resemble more of the Seattle and Portland type weather. And so they've got a little bit better weather for riding, but boy, they've done some great stuff. And that video is well worth the, I think it's about a half an hour long. That is worth watching. Definitely worth watching. I thought that was good. Mechanical Minute and Bike Tips this week is going to be Bike Pogies 101. What's a bike pogie, you ask? What the heck is that? It's something that will change your winter game, basically, and even some of your fall and cool weather and spring and cool weather riding, too. Bicycle pogies are, as we know them, a thing that you can put your hands into while riding your bike. I've been pushing on these things for years. I think that the only way that I can possibly get out in cold weather and ride my bike and be comfortable. And so we're going to go through a whole explanation of this because I've got a 101 exercise here, which elevates your winter bicycling game. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we roll our way into the show. So let's go right there. For starters, let's just go right into it and see what we have as far as this goes. And let's see. Come on now. Where did I put them? I put them somewhere here. There we are. So these are interesting devices that you put on the end of your handlebars. They go on flat bars. You can put them different styles, can go onto drop bars. And essentially what you do is you insert your hands in and you've got full control of the levers and your hands stay toasty. And I mean toasty, toasty warm. So they're really wonderful. Says here, bike pogies have arrived. The ever-evolving landscape of bicycle commuting. Bicyclists are constantly seeking new solutions to enhance the experience, especially during colder seasons. A rising trend is gaining traction in cities and the adoption of these bike pogies, versatile hand covers designed to keep cyclists warm and comfortable during chilly rides with or wet rides or whatever rides you're going to go on. So they work really, really good. And I got to tell you, the first time I put a set of these on my bike, I was out on a mountain bike ride. And I had them on, of course, my cyclocross bike, because I don't really or never really owned a mountain bike for very long. And all my friends are laughing at me and going, "What's that goofy stuff on your handlebars?" And I said, "Well, you guys have no idea." Well, it was a night ride. And that night ride meant that we were wearing and or had lights on our bikes because we were riding on trails at night. And I had a headlight on the top of my helmet, which I always ride with when I'm riding at night, because I think that's like the absolute answer to seeing exactly where you're going as far as, you know, taking turns while you're riding your bike. If you turn your bike to the left, you want to see what's off to the left. You can look over there first. You can see exactly what you need to anticipate. And I just think they're great. I always keep one on the front of my handlebars too, because it lights up the trail or the path or the road in front of me. I can't say enough about never put just one light on your bike, put two on. It's worth it. It's worth it. That one on top of your helmet is a lifesaver. It really is. So anyway, moving on, let's go back to my story. So back to my story, and that story is that we came to a stop and everybody's, you know, they're blowing on their hands, on their gloves, and, you know, because they're cold. I take my very lightly gloved hands out of my covers that are on my handlebars. And because I had a headlight on, I held my hands up and my hands were steaming. Yeah, steaming. No kidding. And everybody went, "Oh my God, look at Ron's hands." And I went, "Guys, I'm telling you, this is the answer." And the gloves I was wearing, they were not heavy duty winter gloves at all. What I like about them is they give you the dexterity you're looking for. You're able to still operate your bicycle and with your fingers without them being frozen to death. It's really a pleasure to ride with them. So their bike pogies are short for what we call hand pocket gloves, okay? And a recent addition to your cyclist toolkit. These hand covers attach to the handlebars, creating a windproof and insulated enclosure for the rider's hands. Unlike handlebar controls, Some commuters even have their bike bells operable inside the Pogie, so it still works in the cold weather. It's going to get muffled a little bit, but if you got a good bell, it'll work just fine. So it's just a really cool thing. So here is advantages for urban commuters. For the city cyclists, the benefits of the Pogie extends beyond warmth. It's the ease of slipping hands in and out of the Pogies, making quick stops, signaling, navigating through traffic more efficiently. Additionally, their design allows cyclists to maintain a relaxed grip on the handlebars, reducing strain during longer commutes. The growing popularity of these is evident, and it's expanding market offerings and positive user testimonials. Cyclists appreciate the enhanced comfort and adaptability that Pogies bring to their daily rides, particularly in cities where commuting efficiency is paramount. So you can really, I have two problems with riding in the cold. That's why I don't ride in the cold. But, you know, I'm a wimp. I got a little older. I become more sensitive to the cold. And yes, that does happen, you youngsters out there that I saw riding down my road last week on a day that I wouldn't even think about being out. But, you know, we're close to a university campus, and they were probably college students because they're young, and their blood pours warmer than mine does. But anyway, people do, and I used to be one of those people. A tip of the cycling cap to those guys for being out in the cold weather. I just can't do it anymore. If you can do it, and you can withstand the hand problem and what I like to call the agony of defeat, yes, the feet problem, you know, go for it. But I've never overcome the foot thing, and I've tried lots of different things, including battery rechargeable heated insoles, electric socks, all sorts of things like that. I just can't take care of the feet. I can't take care of the toes. The toes just are unhappy in cold weather, no matter what level of wool sock I wear, because wool is the only thing I can wear in cold weather. As a matter of fact, I spend most of my year in wool socks because I really like the way they feel. There are different types of these things out there, different designs, and they're made by different manufacturers. There's a number of companies out there, Barmitz, Rock Brothers, 45 North Cobra Fist. I don't know that one. That's a new one. So there's a few different companies out there do it. I do have a lot of experience with Barmitz because that's Barmitts. That's not Bar Mitzvah. It's Barmitz. So I have a lot of experience with them because for a short period of time, I was actually repping that product when they first came out to the market. And that's where I was able to show people exactly, you know, how they worked and how good they were. And I even had some samples that I would, you know, hand off to a shop and say, you guys try these, you know, for a couple of weeks. I'll be back in 2 weeks to pick them up, but tell me what you think. And by the time I would get back to pick them up, they'd already put their order in because they're that good. They really do work well. But there are different designs out there. These other ones here from Rock Brothers are very, very cool looking. They are very much more sophisticated looking, and they look interesting. The key effect here is most of these are lined with some sort of a fleece type lining in the inside, and they are on the outside, they tend to be a waterproof, rainproof, windproof nylon of some sort. And they don't even have to be completely protective against moisture. It just makes a huge difference just to keep the wind and the cold off of your hands. Makes a big difference. One thing you might understand, especially you bicycle mechanics out there, you ever pick up a cold tool, you know, like you got a wrench that's been sitting outside or, you know, it sits on a piece of cold pavement or whatever, and you pick it up and you go, oh my God, this thing is freezing cold. Same thing happens with your brake levers and your handlebars because they are not made out of anything that doesn't get really, really cold in the cold weather. So this avoids that particular problem and situation. They really do have a wonderful function. And for those of you who are worried about them, and am I going to not have as good a control on my bike and all that, just like anything, just like, I hate to say this, but just like riding a bicycle, you kind of figure it out after a while. You get used to it, become accustomed to what it is. They're not what you think they are as far as losing control on your bike. They really, really, really work well. So that would be my thing that I would emphasize here. And, you know, it's just really a wonderful, wonderful invention. And I think they're great. I just think they're absolutely great. The other thing that you can think of is, you know, you do actually gain a little better performance on your bike because you're not worried about your hands being cold all the time. It's definitely a big, big, big deal. And it is the holiday season, and you know, you still got a few minutes left. So go down to your local bike shop, see if they have anything like this. You know, you can pick this up for yourself and you can hand it to your significant other or otherwise and say, here, give me this for Christmas or give me this for Hanukkah. You can always improvise. It makes a really nice gift and something that a lot of people don't break down and get for themselves because they kind of look at them and go, I don't know, that looks silly. But then if you receive them as a gift, you're kind of obligated to give them a try. I'm telling you, once you go there, you'll never go back. You will never, ever, ever go back. They make a huge difference. That's my mechanical minute and tip for the week. It's all about bike pogies or hand protectors, basically bar mitts as they're known by another company, and they blow away any type of technical mitten or glove I have ever worn on the bicycle. They just really make a huge difference. So that is that. Let's move on to the next piece here. Streets Blog New York City had an article that came out last week, and it was all about the New York Police Department that has ramped up its enforcement for squeezing pedestrians, but in a kind of a suspect manner. So I get the I don't want my bicycle on a sidewalk and if I'm a pedestrian situation. I'm a big proponent of keeping bicycles on the road where they belong or on a bike path where they belong. If it's got wheels, it should be on the road, not on the sidewalk. That's my opinion, I guess you could say. Some people don't look at this very positively when I talk about it, but it is my opinion, and I believe it is there because of it's a safety factor here. If a bicycle hits a pedestrian on a sidewalk at any kind of speed, say 20 miles an hour, which I often see, especially around my town here on campus, somebody's going to get hurt. And it could be the person on the bicycle, but it's more than likely going to be the person who is the pedestrian, or maybe even another cyclist. So they just don't belong there. New York City feels the same way. So they enforce it, and they are ramping up their enforcement against cyclists for riding on the sidewalk, but they continue to do so in kind of a haphazard and racially suspect manner. There's new data that reveals that in the 12 months from October of 24 to September of 25, cops wrote 5,068 summons for unlawful bicycle riding on sidewalks, up nearly 69% from the previous 12 months. That's a big increase. Now, it could be a big increase because they've gotten a lot more complaints, and so therefore they have decided to do something about it. I know my son complains about it out in Chicago because the cyclists out there, most of them are very good, very law-abiding. They're very responsible. They're paying attention because they don't want to get hurt either. But there are those that violate the rules. And of course, when you violate the rules, you know, things go a little chaotic. That's why we have traffic lights. And that's why we have certain rules for certain things. But the racial breakdown of the crackdown, okay, just so you know, suggests that a push for safer space for pedestrians is being carried out in a disproportionate way. Black cyclists got 37.1% of the sidewalk riding tickets, but blacks comprise just 20% of the city population. Do a little math there. I'll let you figure it out. Hispanic cyclists got 34.4% of the tickets, and they comprise 28.3% of the population. The numbers are off. The numbers are way off. Meanwhile, white people, and to a lesser degree, Asian people, are getting tickets at a lower than their portion of the population. White cyclists got 10.1% of the tickets in the most recent period, even though white people comprise 31% of the population, and Asian cyclists got 13.6% of the tickets, even though they comprise 15.6% of the population. Part of the reason for the disparity is that New York Police Department seems to be enforcing the law against riding on the sidewalk almost by whim, as demonstrated by a map, and they have a map here with this article that goes along with this article that you can actually see it. The sidewalk tickets for the first three quarters of 2025, entire precincts included, those on the Upper East, Park Slope, Bensonhurst, and Flushing, all of Staten Island, are rating few sidewalk tickets, while enforcement seems to be an obsession of the precinct commanders in Chinatown portion of Sunset Park, a strip of Flatbush, most of Harlem, Roosevelt Avenue in Corona, and East New York. The blank zone on the Upper East Side and the crowded spot on Sunset Park are the most glaring examples. What's going on here? Let's just take a look at this. When asked about the data, NYPD spokesperson, who did not provide a name, said that the cops were deployed in direct response to community complaints. Makes sense. Somebody calls up, says, hey, I almost got hit by a bicycle. What's going on? Isn't this illegal? And so they step up to law enforcement, right? The NYPD has increased enforcement of illegal biking in some areas, the spokesperson continued. Officers are deployed to areas where those complaints are received most and where violations are observed. NYPD officers carry out their work without consideration of race or ethnicity, and enforcement is conducted impartially. The claim of the racial bias is really difficult to prove, but the other claim that the NYPD officers respond to where there are the most complaints is very easily debunked, and here's how. Of the 250-odd 311 complaints, it's a 311 response, that get sent to NYPD, there's only one that relates to biking on the sidewalk. In the first three quarters of 2025, there are only 1,118 such complaints, according to New York's open data portal for 311 service requests. As you can see from the map that they show here, and you can't see that because we're on the radio. But anyway, they don't match up with the places where the NYPD is writing tickets for the infraction. Where they come from? So the 311 complaints are coming from, for instance, the NYPD received 120 complaints of sidewalk riding in the southmost part of Staten Island, yet wrote no tickets there. And in the community board 8 of Eastern Queens, the agency received 42 complaints of sidewalk riding and again wrote no tickets. And in the community board that covers Canarsie, and the public made all of 9 complaints, yet the NYPD's precinct area wrote more than 369 tickets. Ooh, boy, oh boy, oh boy. The increased ticket writing over the 12-month period overlaps with NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch's decision in March to ramp up criminal summons against bicycles, though it is unclear why the racial breakdown is so disproportionate in the riding on the sidewalk tickets, which are not criminal summons. So that said, criminal riding on the sidewalk summons have been even more dramatic and racial disparity, with white people getting just 5.8% of those criminal summons. Some of that can be explained by the fact that many of the bike riders receiving criminal summons in Tisch's crackdown are delivery workers, and a large percentage of those riders are Blacks, Latinos, and Asians. The NYPD's apparent disproportionate enforcement of traffic infractions is an ongoing concern. According to new statistics posted by one convenient place by data scientist Jahia Zabotar, it's easy to draw the conclusion that the NYPD officers are more likely to write tickets to blacks and Latinos. For example, blacks and Latinos received 95.4 of the tickets for consumption of alcohol inside of a vehicle, and though they comprise less than half the population of the city, must be percent, and then it wasn't written here. Blacks and Latinos receive 90% of the tickets for driving an unregistered vehicle, though, as just mentioned, they comprise less than half the population of the city. Blacks and Latinos receive almost 83% of the tickets for reckless driving, though, as we might have mentioned, they comprise less than half the population of the city. Blacks and Latinos receive 80% of the tickets for idling, though they comprise, as we might have just said, less than half the population of the city. So you can see where things are just a bit askew here. There's some profiling being done, and the people that are calling in the complaints are not getting the service that they're looking for, because if they're calling in complaints from an area that is having a lot of violations and nobody shows up to take care of it, but then goes after a neighborhood that isn't calling in any complaints, there's something way, way off here. So this goes along with my rant of the week. This is definitely, it's when law enforcement goes bad. I'm not against law enforcement. I think it's fine as long as you're doing your job right. But it's when you start swaying and using an excuse because there's an ordinance out against the cyclists, but you use it in an area where there aren't the same number of cyclists that are violating that ordinance, you got some problems. So NYPD, get your act together, please. Please, please, please get your act together. You have one of the fastest growing cycling populations in the United States right now. You're number one on the League of American Bicyclists list for 2025, and you're just doing it backwards. So you're creating all these wonderful bike lanes. People are riding in the bike lanes. Everything's going really well. You're working on your infrastructure. You're working on your arteries and the veins that come into them. You're doing lots and lots and lots of good things. Why don't we just put the same emphasis into ticketing cars that run red lights? There's an idea. And it doesn't matter what part of the city you go for. I don't care. But I would say that you might want to pay attention to the places that have most of the bike lanes, because that's where someone's going to get hurt. So anyway, that's my rant. I'm going to leave it alone from that point right there, because there's so much more to talk about. And let's see what we got here. Let's move on to another thing that I mentioned earlier in the show that I was going to talk about. Why governments should start paying people to bike to work. There's an intriguing idea, isn't it? I think it's a great idea. So governments should pay people to bike to work. This simple yet powerful policy can address some of our most pressing challenges: improving public health, combating climate change, reducing traffic congestion, and enhancing the mental well-being. All good stuff. By incentivizing cycling, we can create more people centered in cities that prioritize clean air, physical activity, and a vibrant community. In the latest news from the UK government, Cycle to Work scheme, which allows employees to buy bicycles and e-bikes through a tax-free salary sacrifice. It will remain unchanged after the 2025 budget, despite rumors of a new 2,000 euro spending cap. The Treasury confirmed no cap will be reintroduced, preserving access to higher cost e-bikes and cargo bikes that many workers use to replace their car trips. The program cost the Treasury, it rose sharply from 55 million euros in 2019 to 20 to 130 million in 2024 to 25. Critics argue it disproportionately benefits higher earners. Industry and cycling advocates say it delivers far greater economic health and congestion reduction benefits, with only a small minority of the vouchers exceeding 2,000 euros. Financially rewarding, bike commuters will not only decrease emissions, but they'll also reduce the strain on healthcare systems, boost productivity, and promote a higher quality of life for urban dwellers. In a world increasingly aware of the urgent need for sustainable solutions, paying people to ride a bike to work is a no-brainer. In North America, where cars reign supreme, a powerful idea could gain some ground in some areas like it does in Europe, paying people to bike to work. As our cities grapple with the traffic congestion, pollution, and sedentary lifestyles, it's time to consider a new approach. The next step beyond incentivizing the purchase of e-bikes and actually paying people to commute to work and leave their car at home is phenomenal what you can do with this. North America needs to follow Europe's lead in incentivizing cycling to work, uncovering the benefits of both individuals and of the environment. The rise of the e-bike has been a very, very big factor here. A lot more people riding e-bikes, a lot more people are finding great purpose for them. The capability of the e-bike to carry more cargo and the advent of the cargo bike and what's going on with the cargo bike, it just makes cycling a much friendlier way of transporting yourself around a big city. It's also less congestion because bicycles don't clog roads like automobiles do. So there's that factor going there. Electric bicycles, affectionately known as e-bikes, have seamlessly blended the convenience of a motorized travel with the health benefits of pedaling. The two-wheeled wonders have become equipped with electric motors and batteries, offering helping hand to a rider as they conquer steep hills and zip through their daily commutes at a little bit higher speed. For many, e-bikes have become the perfect solution, allowing them to arrive at work without breaking a sweat while still enjoying the benefits of moderate physical activity. So the e-bike thing is a really big deal. So the shift towards e-bikes is not just a personal choice, but a societal one, one fueled by innovative bike-to-work programs. These initiatives, prevalent across many European countries, take the form of tax incentives that reward employees for cycling to work instead of driving personal cars. The concept's simple. Swap your car keys for bike pedals and your monthly paycheck gets a tax-free bonus. The trend of paying Belgians to ride to work is not just on the rise. It's set to become the mandate, revolutionizing how people commute. And in recent years, the number of employees receiving bicycle allowance has surged, and this upward trajectory is expected to continue as Belgium's bicycle allowance becomes obligatory. In 2022, nearly one in three employees, 29% in Belgium, voluntarily provided their workers with a bicycle allowance. This allowance, calculated based on the distance commuted by bicycle, has become a sought-after perk with the share of Belgium's benefiting from it doubling in just the past 5 years, from 7% in 2017 to 14% in 2022, according to HR service provider SD Works. The geographical distribution of this benefit varies, with Flanders leading the way, where almost one in five private employees, 18%, receive a bicycle allowance, where in Brussels, it's just a modest 5%. What's even more exciting, though, is the mandatory bicycle allowance. The shift will undoubtedly boost the number of cyclists on the road, those who commute by bike, but didn't yet have a specific bike allowance through a collective bargaining agreement and are to receive tax-free allowances of 0.27 euros per kilometer from May 1st of 2023 and up from the 0.25 euros per kilometer in 2022. The agreement between employer and employee representation within the National Labor Council ensures that this allowance covers a maximum of 40 kilometers per day, equating to a daily maximum of 10.80 euros. So it's going to pay you back, is what it's going to do. In 2021, one in seven employees, 14%, received a cycling allowance. That is a decrease of one-third pre-coronavirus. It was also one in four, 22% at that time. The mobility of light electric vehicle trade has made a huge difference in numbers and participation in these programs. The median amount per cyclist per year increased from 73.92 euros in 2019 to 91.20 euros in 2020. However, it fell again to 76.80 for the first 8 months of 2021. The allowance is a great incentive to get employees back on their bicycles. This is, you know, there's other countries doing this. You take a look at France. Employers are required to reimburse employees for costs of renting a bike for commuting under the French Labor Code, Article L3261-2. This reimbursement can cover up to 100% of bike rental costs, and it's exempt from social charges and income tax, provided the employee submits proof of expense. This reimbursement is not for outright purchasing of bikes, but for using rental services or public bike schemes. So all those city bikes that you see now in the big cities, they're covering it in France. So if you need to rent a bike, if you're using one of those apps to rent your city bike and get yourself around, you can get 100% reimbursement in France. French kind of have things figured out sometimes better than others. So do the Belgians. So, I mean, everybody does over in Europe. They're all much more open-minded about this transportation thing than we are here in North America, that's for sure. We've definitely got some problems. So look at the number of emissions and the transportation costs, the parking costs, the maintenance on the road costs. It all is reduced dramatically when bicycles become the source of transportation. So while France is indeed encouraging cycling to work, it's through a different system, and it focuses on reimbursement and tax exemptions rather than a direct per kilometer payment. You can work it out for sure. One of the best known examples for incentivizing bicycle commuting comes from the United Kingdom. Introduced in 1999, the Cycle to Work Scheme is a government-backed initiative designed to encourage employees to purchase bikes and cycling gear through a tax efficiency leasing model. Under the scheme, workers can save between 32 and 47% on the cost of a new bicycle and accessories, depending on their income tax bracket. And so here's how it works. The employees choose a bike and any necessary gear, helmets, lights, locks, more than hire through their employer. Payments are deducted from the gross salary from a wage sacrifice arrangement, meaning that they pay no tax or national insurance on the value of the equipment. After the lease period, usually 12 months, they can choose to extend the hire, return the bike, or purchase it at fair market value. Since its launch, the scheme has been widely adopted, over 1.6 million commuters participating through more than 40,000 registered employers. The goals are clear: to promote healthier journeys to work, reduce environmental pollution, help shift commuting habits, and lower low carbon alternatives. While the scheme doesn't offer direct per kilometer payments like Belgium or the Netherlands, it represents a significant upfront financial incentive that lowers the barrier for entry for new cyclists. Particularly as bike prices, especially e-bikes, can be a major hurdle, this type of support makes sustainable commuting more accessible. Importantly, the UK government has updated the scheme in recent years and allowed for higher value bike packages, including e-bikes, which were once restricted by the outdated price caps. This charge acknowledges the growing role of electric bicycles in extended commuting distances and flattening hill terrain, critical for making cycling viable for more people across a variety of geographies. While the UK still faces challenges in terms of cycling infrastructure and road safety compared to its European neighbors, the Cycle to Work schemes continues to be a key pillar of the country's sustainable transportation strategy, a practical, popular program that shows how financial incentives can catalyze change, even in a car-centric culture. And of course, the Netherlands is the blueprint for success. It's globally renowned for its deep-rooted cycling culture, where bikes outnumber people and dedicated cycling lanes stretch across the entire country. But beyond the infrastructure and cultural habits, the Dutch have implemented smart financial policies that make biking to work not only easy, but economically rewarding. At the heart of the Dutch incentive system is the bicycle allowance. Anyway, Dutch employees who commute by bike can receive tax-free reimbursements up to 0.21 euros per kilometer from their employers. The allowance is applied to is typically arranged through the employer payroll system, making it seamless and automatic for commuters and workers. For a commuter cycling 10 kilometers each way, they can add up to over 80 euros per month, entirely tax-free. This model benefits both employers and employees. For employers, supporting cycling helps reduce parking costs, promotes healthier staff, and cuts down on carbon footprints, important metrics in the environmental social governance reporting. For employees, it turns a daily habit into direct financial gain. Notably, the Netherlands has also encouraged employers to lease bikes to employees tax-free, similar to the company car, but with fewer emissions and costs. The Dutch approach doesn't stop at subsidies. It's backed by over 35,000 kilometers of protected bike paths, bike parking facilities at nearly every train station, and policies that treat cyclists as a first-class mode of transport. Big tip of the hat to the Netherlands and what they're doing. This is, you know, it's also happening in Spain. There is an e-bike incentive gaining momentum in North America. And I say North America because it's probably more in Canada than it is here in the United States. That is not unusual. You take a look at cities like Los Angeles, which have been choked with traffic congestion for decades, getting more people on e-bikes in a climate that offers the ideal bike and commuting weather all year round is just a no-brainer. And of course, more infrastructure is needed as well, but not just more bikes, but or it'll just be a wasted effort. You know, people ask me all the time, well, how can we make our roads safer? And I say, put more bicycles on the road. That is the answer, by the way. More bicycles give you more presence out on the road. They give the motorists a visual excuse to slow down, which is really key and very, very important. And the more bikes you put on the road, the more people are forced to slow down and pay attention more to the law. And also, let's go back there, pay attention while driving their vehicles and not be staring at their cell phones while they're driving their car down the road, which is one of the big crimes out there right now. If we can keep the drivers from being distracted because they're more interested in seeing or more concerned about seeing a cyclist every mile or two, as that they have to navigate around, then they will be put in a situation where to be a responsible driver, they are going to have to pay more attention. And that's all we can hope for. I'm not saying this can become a cure overnight, but it can eventually become a big time cure for our overindulgence in the motorized vehicle here in the United States. When you take a look at the average car in the United States being close to new car costs being close to $50,000, maybe it's even exceeded that. That's a tremendous amount of money and outlay for a regular working person to be able to afford. And it makes transporting yourself closer to impossible than possible in this country. So we have to figure this out because we are on a really, really bad path as far as congestion goes, as far as pollution goes, as far as our environment goes. We're not in a really great situation right now, and the bicycle can solve a number of problems, not to mention the health benefits. So anyway, that's a little piece there about why governments should start paying people to bike to work. I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea. It's wonderful. Unfortunately, I'm sure it probably just won't happen in my lifetime, but I'm starting to see little peak previews of it and happening. So that's always a good thing. Let's see if I can find this here. The other thing that I had mentioned is I watched a video. I watched it this morning, so it was very, very interesting. And the video was about BC, British Columbia, and Vancouver, in particular, British Columbia. And this video was wonderful because it really kind of showed how the structure of all this works if you sit down and do it right. And it really helps if you've got some good model cities to look at and see how it all works. What do you do when you're trying to build a bicycle structure in your city? And I'll just throw a few tips out there. You start with the busiest road. I know, it seems counterproductive. Well, why would I want to put a bike lane on the busiest road in my town? Why would I want to do that? Because the busiest road is busy because it is the artery. If you look at everything as arteries and veins, all right, you have to build the arterial system first, and then you build the veins off of it that goes off into the neighborhoods. So if you can find an especially busy road, and there's one in Chicago, and it's Milwaukee, and it crosses the city, and it's got a bike lane all the way through on both sides, protected bike lane, I might add, all the way through. That I may be off on that if anybody from Chicago is listening, and I've missed on something. It just appears that a lot of that road and that avenue is covered with bike lanes. So that's a great start. And then from there, if you've got side roads that are quiet because they're residential and there are, you know, numbers of apartment buildings or houses or whatever that are on that, you probably don't really need to build the veins unless it's a particularly busy side street, which brings you to maybe a larger development of houses or to a number of businesses, whatever it may be, in which case it's nice to build something there too. This can very easily be monitored by traffic control. And you can see very, very simply where the need is and where it is not. So there's a lot of ways of doing this and making it work. So start with your busiest street and then branch out from there. And that is the way to do it. And that is what they did in Victoria, BC. Started with a main artery and then they worked their way out. And the unbelievable part about it is the number of e-cargo bikes that there are in that city. The percentage is so much higher than, let's say, Montreal. And Montreal obviously has more cyclists because it has a lot more people. And yet Montreal also has a lot more weather. It's probably all snowy up there right now. And I'm sure it's really cold because we're getting the Canadian cold that's blowing down on us right here, right now. And I woke up to a whopping 11 degrees this morning. That's Fahrenheit, not Celsius. So it was definitely cold. And of course, the wind was coming out of the northwest at about 15 or 20 miles an hour. It just makes it extremely uncomfortable to be out riding a bicycle. Yet in Montreal, they've got this great infrastructure and they ride year round. And if you take a look at other places like Minneapolis, another one of the hottest bike cities in the United States, not by temperature, by participation. And they actually plow their bike lanes and, you know, they pay attention to winter because they have winter. And they also pay attention to the fact that people aren't going to stop riding their bikes just because there's some snow on the ground. So there are solutions out here, but you can't act on a solution until you identify those that could be solving the problem. So again, I encourage you to take a look at this particular YouTube channel. It's called The Urbanity, and it talks all about foot, bike, and public transportation. I highly encourage it. I think it's a great site, and there's numerous videos I think you will be entertained by when you go there. I'm going to go on to the cross nationals and the shout outs thereof. So one of the things I mentioned early in the show as I was introducing the cyclocross nationals and what happened this past weekend is the first day, there's a number of days that break down to do the cross nationals. So there's a whole breakdown, different days, and there are different races on different days. So the first day, they ran some of the Masters races. And one of those Masters races was the Masters 70 plus. So that's 70 up to 74, I believe. And then once you hit 75, you go into a different category. Our very own David Rustico from Plantsville, Connecticut, who is a longtime supporter of A, Bicycle Talk, and B, also a long supporter of the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross race. He won the Nationals again this year at 70. So he was followed very closely by, I believe there was about a 30 or 40 second gap between him and David Goodwin, also a rider at the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross race. And he was second place, and he is from Sunderland, Massachusetts. And from Edgartown, Massachusetts, Frank Jennings was third place. So 1, 2, 3 in the 70 plus Masters. New England, the heart of cyclocross, the heartbeat of cyclocross. It's really kind of a cool thing. And I can break it all down for you, but the other major shout out, and in that collegiate race circuit, there was a woman who is still in college. Her name comes up often on my show. It's Lizzie Gonzalez, and Lizzie is from Dudley, Massachusetts, and she just won the Pan Am Games a few weeks back. This was the varsity race. It was Lizzie Gonzalez from Dudley, Massachusetts, and she rides for Marion University. She was first by about 9 seconds, close race, but you know, that's not as close as they get, I can tell you that. So anyway, big shout out to Lizzie. She's just riding unbelievably well right now. I knew her when she was just a small child, and her dad would bring her down to my cross races, and she would race there. And to see where she has gone with her cycling career is just really, really fun. But when we go to junior 9-10 men, we go to David Borsesky. I don't think I got your name quite right there, David, but he's from Weetog, Connecticut, and he was first place overall. And he's from the CCAP Farmington Valley Youth Cycling. Shout out to those guys. CCAP, once again, one of the better programs in the United States for cycling development for juniors. Yes, junior 15, 16, Abby Cole from East Granby, Connecticut, who rides for Competitive Edge Cycling, was second place overall. And I do believe that her sister, Lillian, was sixth place overall. That's really cool. Once again, we see these guys out at the cyclocross race out in Mansfield Center here at Mansfield Hollow. So I know I'm a little biased here, but you know what? I started cyclocross in New England, in Connecticut, in 1983, the very first cyclocross race in Connecticut ever. And that race is still going on. It was not continuous through all those years. There were some gaps and some different race directors involved and things that are running around, but I have kept it alive, and I just really believe in it, and I think it's really, really good. So on the last day of Nationals, which would have been on Sunday, the 14th, I think is when that was, we had the Masters 45-1-2-3. And we have one rider, Stephen Shive, from 7th place from Greenwich, Connecticut, who is from New England, that was in that race and did well. Now we go on to the Pro 1-2 men. We didn't really have anybody in New England all until we get to 20th place, which was Michael Mark. Then I have to go back to the Pro 1-2-3 senior female, and number one, by 1 second, from Dudley, Massachusetts, was Lizzie Gonzalez. Yay, Lizzie. You're getting a lot of shout outs on this show over the last few weeks. I am very impressed with where you are, where you're from. Yeah, you're a little late to the party, but yeah, Dave Rustico is actually online right now, and he's watching the show. So, hey, Dave, great job. Great job. Again, great job. Looked really dry and fast to me. If you can comment on that, then I will come back to you. That's the impression I got on the course, is that it was very dry and it seemed like because of that it would be fast, but there were some serious run-ups. There were some definite heavy dismounts on uphills. The course looked difficult enough. A very close winding course, so probably very spectator-friendly too. It looked pretty cool. And that was in Fayetteville, by the way, if you're in Fayetteville, Arkansas, if I got that right. Hopefully I do. So anyway, I would be really interested in hearing your interpretation of the course, Dave, if you're still watching. So Lizzie, yikes, she's just 1 second. There is a video on YouTube of the Nats men's and women's elite finish. And you get to see just how close that race was. It was incredibly close. A lot of back and forth. Killer race. Lizzie pulls it off at the end. That last little run-up with the two dismounts on it, I think is where she got enough time there. Second place finisher, who was Catherine Sarkozy. She is from North Potomac, Maryland. She definitely, and then she was followed by, it looks like, another Sarkozy, Alicia, and then Cassidy Hickey. The times, I gotta read the times to you, because this is how close it was. 51:57, finishing winning time. 51:58, second place. 52:04, third place. 52:09, fourth place. That is one heck of a race. Anyway, shout out to all my New England riders that participated in this year's Nationals. We love you all. We appreciate everything you've done to help New England and cyclocross. Any of the riders that were out there from CCAP, big, big shout out to you. Also, Cyclocross Nationals were, once again, very productive for New England riders this year. I am I'm definitely all behind it. Next year is coming. We're already in the planning phases for next year as to what we're going to do. I have to talk to my group about possible date change because of the insanely busy activity level I have working now as the local registrar of voters in town, and my overlap with cyclocross season. It's a little tight these days. But anyway, so I may be a little earlier this next year than I was. So I'm going to try to get somebody to swap out with me for the date. But anyway, yeah, Cross Nationals, what a good time. Fun to watch if you had a subscription to a particular streaming service, you could have watched it live, and that's how we see it here, because I gotta see my bike racing, it's a big thing. Oh, many short, steep off camber humps, huh? Yeah, it looked like there was some definite interesting stuff. Boy, if any of that had been wet, it would have been a much, much bigger deal. Dave also says, I'm communicating right now with Dave Rustico, back to Fayetteville for 2026. Need the Hollow to prepare. Yes, I'll get you going. Don't worry. Don't worry. Mansfield Hollow also throws a big challenge at you early season, and we'll keep you fine-tuned for your next venture out at Fayetteville. Maybe we should sit down and, grab a bite to eat together or something, or grab a coffee and sit and talk about the course and tell me about what you saw and what you think we could do at Mansfield. Actually, we got to have Keith in on that conversation too, because Keith is my mastermind. He and Dave both are the masterminds of the cross course. So let's see what we have to do to put together something that helps you prepare. I thought we had a pretty good course this year. Yeah, it would have been brutal if it was wet. I could tell. It just would have been nasty if that was wet. But I don't know what they get for moisture in Fayetteville, but it looked really hard packed and dry. Good stuff. Thanks for chiming in, Dave. It's nice to hear from you, and nice to see you back, and hopefully you're home for the holidays, and hope you have a good holiday with your family and all. We'll definitely talk soon. Remember, bicycling is freedom. Life is better for everyone when people ride more bikes. Cycling is easier and safer option for most people, because when more people ride bikes, people are happier, healthier, our communities are safer and friendlier, our planet is greener. Together, we can help get more people to know the joy of bicycling. I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. You got to get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, price of gas, and the lack of places to safely ride, and do your part. And hey, take the Pedal and Ron challenge. Park your car or truck for one day. Use your bicycle instead. You are going to surprise yourself. Remember, when you're out riding your bike, whether you're riding your bike or you're driving a car, please be safe. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk. If you're watching on Facebook Live, you can feel free to comment down here below. If you'd like to send me an email, it's bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thank you for listening. Get on your bikes and ride!